Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you all for coming to the third Winnicker lecture this term. It's a great honour that we have with us today Professor Andrew Pickering. Andrew is one of these rare creatures who manages to get not one, but two PhDs. Those of you who are still struggling, I'm not sure if you just feel a bit annoyed, really, but there we are. So his first was in physics in London, and then in science studies in Edinburgh, which became actually the centre of a certain kind of science studies, a sociological approach to science, which was tremendously provocative and exciting for those of us involved in philosophy of science and science studies, wrote a book, Constructing Quarks, A Sociological History of Particle Physics, that was also all of those things I just said, exciting and provocative. And then two or three more books, I don't think I'll be able to recall them all, but it's very important that I say them, because after all, this is how the speaker gets to perhaps sell one or two books. So I'm going to actually look at my list. One of them is The Mangle of Practice. Yes, yes. But then the most recent one, oh, this is the wrong thing. Sorry. Well, I'll do it from memory. The most recent one is The Cybernetic Mind.
Brain.
Cybernetic Brain, which only came out, I think, 2010. So that's the important one, which you want to go and look at the bookshops for. So today, I don't have my title, I don't have the title. Being in an environment of formative discussion. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thanks very much for the introduction.
Do you mind if I sit down and give this talk? I'm going to sit like this. Well, I'm delighted to be here. Very nice of Laura to invite me. I looked at the list of the other speakers in this series and I was totally overawed. It's a great honour to be included and I feel a bit intimidated. Laura's invitation to me included a couple of organising questions which I kept in mind while I was writing this talk. They were, how do socio-ecological systems work and how are they best governed? I'm a total amateur in any of these areas. But what I'm going to try to do is to lay out my own general perspective on some of the issues, my way of thinking about what's entailed in being in an environment. And I'm told we have to be out of here by 6:30, so if you don't mind, I'll kind of speak quite quickly. Can you hear me at the back? No? All right. In 1995, I published a book called The Mangle of Practice, Time, Agency, and Science. Bit of advertising, not a very clear photo. And all of my subsequent work has grown out of that. The analysis of scientific practice that I laid out there was straightforward enough, I thought, and most people seem to get the hang of it. But as I've taken the story further over the past few years, things have got a bit weird. Though it all makes sense to me, in the last few years, I've increasingly had the feeling that I've talked my way out of all known academic discourses. So one thing that I want to do today is just to try to clarify, basically to myself, my position as well as I can, and at the same time, to relate it to environmental questions. The key move in that book was to focus on performance rather than cognition. We've all been taught to think of science as primarily a cognitive activity, the production of knowledge about the world. But my argument there was that if you want to understand scientific practice, you should start by thinking about A, the performance of scientists, what scientists do, B, the performance of the world, what things do in the laboratory, and C, how these performances are interlaced with one another. Now, you might think that this is obvious. Of course, scientists struggle with the material world and try and come to terms with it. But actually, at least as far as the dominant academic traditions are concerned, it isn't obvious. The natural sciences tell us stories about how the material world is. The social sciences do the same for the human world. But neither of them talk about performative struggles between the two. There's a spectacular silence, a striking lack of systematic thought on this topic. To that extent, Western education continually reproduces a Cartesian cognitivism and a Cartesian dualism of people and things. Now, it might be that there's a reason for this silence, namely that there's nothing worth saying about performative interactions of people and things. But in the mangle, I did develop a few concepts that seemed to me to get somewhere, that broke the scholarly silence in ways that are worth taking further. One key concept was agency. People ask me to define this, and I can't, really. But it refers to action, doing things that are consequential in the world. All I can do is point to examples and say, think about agency like this. And I don't think it's hard, actually. And if I can get away with the word agency, then I can say that the key idea of the mangle was that scientific practice has the character of a dance of agency between people and things, the human and the non-human. The first case study in the book is about Donald Glaser's work in developing the bubble chamber as a new device for experimental particle physics. Very simply, along the way to the finished device, Glaser built all sorts of different material setups. Then he would stand back with a movie camera in his hand to record what they did. Then he would react to whatever they did, somehow reconfiguring the setup. Then he would see what that new version would do, react to that, and so on and so on. So here's an example of a dance of agency. Sometimes Glaser acted as a classical human agent. Then he would become passive, and the apparatus took over the active role, doing its thing. Then Glaser took over again, back and forth, and eventually a working bubble chamber emerged at the end. These are some of Glaser's prototype chambers on the left. Picture on the right is a kind of time series from left to right, top to bottom, of a bubble, actually, string of bubbles forming and expanding in one of his prototype chambers. I show you this just to remind us all that the activity of the material world is incredibly important. That's a photograph of some tracks from one of his later chambers. It's incredibly difficult to get a machine to produce something like that. This is all pretty simple and obvious. Nobody's ever disputed that this is how things go. But still, this is where my journey into academic outer space started. As I said, there's just no room for talking about performative dances of agency within the mainstream discipline. Importantly here, dances of agency are symmetric. They don't center on or privilege the human. We are agents, but so are rocks and stones, cats and bubble chambers. All of these things act and interact. And especially as far as the human sciences are concerned, symmetry, I think, is heresy. The human sciences play out a sort of human exceptionalism, dwelling endlessly upon what's so special about us. Souls, minds, reason, language, representation, will, intentionality, values, etc., etc. Refusing this exceptionalism, refusing to center the story on human specialness, is what first put me beyond the pale of polite society, I think. One further remark, and then we can move on. Agency, as I use the word, is emergent in practice in a brutal sense. Scientists don't know how material setups will perform in advance. Glaser had to find out what his instruments would do by building them and watching. Likewise, even Glaser himself didn't know in advance how he would react to their performances. Human agency is thus emergent too. That means that traditional causal interpretations of action are importantly misleading, and that we need to think instead about forward-looking evolutionary processes, dances of agency that explore a world of endless emergence and becoming. My story of the mangle was a way of trying to conceptualize that. After writing the mangle, I began to think about ways of generalizing the story beyond the lab. At the end of the book, I claimed that I had a theory of everything. And I quickly realized that our relations with animals, nature, and the environment are an obvious place to look. It might be hard to think about science along these lines. We're all so deeply conditioned to identify science with knowledge. But it's totally obvious that we engage with the environment performatively. In the book, I mentioned the weather, but think about earthquakes and tidal waves. How else could we regard these than as manifestations of the agency of nature, to which we, in turn, react performatively, trying to ward them off, usually through engineering, but never quite succeeding? And to bring this picture down to earth, I fixed on a couple of examples, which I can quickly run through now. One was a story about invasive species, Asian eels in the southern states of the United States. This was an amusing story I found in the newspapers about the importation of these eels to America as pets. They turned out to grow quickly and quite horrifyingly. That's what an Asian eel looks like. If you walk the streets of Seoul, you see them in tanks waiting to be eaten, and they don't look like very friendly creatures. They turned out to grow quickly and rather horrifyingly. The owners threw them out of their aquariums and disposed of them in local ponds, where the eels multiplied and competed successfully for food with the fish. This upset the fishermen, who liked catching largemouth bass, so various tricks were tried to get rid of the eels, for example, draining the ponds. This didn't work because the eels survived by burrowing into the mud, unlike the fish, which died. Then people tried building concrete barriers to stop the eels spreading to other ponds and waterways, but this failed too because the eels just climbed over them. For me, this story is a beautiful example of a dance of agency. Not now in the laboratory, but in the wild. A performative back and forth of the human and the non-human, in which the eels show up as always emergent, surprising, and unpredictable. I want to ontologize this story. I want to take it as a little model of how things go in the world in general. The world is full of agents which can interfere with one another consequentially, but without any sense of control attaching to this. We acted on the eels and made a difference for them, but the outcomes were not as hoped. They were emergent, and vice versa. All this seems to me visibly true, but you just can't say it in the language of mainstream ecology or sociology. Those fields cut up and edit the world in ways that make what I'm talking about vanish. After the eels, I fixed on the Mississippi and John McPhee's wonderful history of the struggles between the river and the US Army Corps of Engineers, the ACE. As McPhee tells it, this has been, again, a story of an emergent, performative back and forth. The river does something, it floods. The ACE does something in response, raising the levees around the river, building control structures. The river responds to that, running higher, washing away the structures, etc., etc., on and on. Again, we have a dance of agency, now writ very large, in which the river, the engineering structures that hem it in, and indeed the social groups and structures that depend on the river, have all been emergently and unpredictably transformed, mangled, as I would say, over the past 150 years or so. So what I take from this is that there are interesting and possibly important things to say about our being in the environment, in the performative idiom, as I call it, which are inexpressible in the language of the mainstream disciplines, civil engineering, hydrology, sociology, whatever. Thinking about dances of agency offers us what seems to me a new perspective on the world, different from that of the conventional natural and social sciences. But so what? Where does this get us? How does this help us in thinking about governing our relations with nature? Here I find myself going yet further into outer space, but I'll try to lay out the basic line of thought. In the late 1990s, the University of Illinois, where I was then working, got a big grant to develop an interdisciplinary capstone undergraduate course to mark the start of the new millennium. They got the money and then they had to find somebody to teach it. And I was one of the people. I ended up co-organizing this course with a chap called Dave Ruzick from our Department of Nuclear Engineering. He taught the opening class, and I remember he started off by calculating the carrying capacity of the Earth. You figure out the total amount of arable land there is, how much it can produce with so much fertilizer, so much genetic engineering. You divide by how much food one person needs to live on. And this gives you an estimate of the total population the Earth can support. And Ruzick actually concluded that we don't need to worry too much at the moment. This is not, of course, an unusual way to reason. The students in this class had no problem with it. And in fact, it might be our usual way of thinking as far as global questions are concerned. It somehow exemplifies our usual way of governing the planet. At the time, I was dumbstruck by the hubris of it all. And now that I've calmed down a bit, I can say why. First, Ruzick's calculations ignore emergence. It assumes that we know all the chains of cause and effect, so that our initiatives will have the expected consequences and only those. We grasp the levers of power through knowledge. Everything I know contradicts this. The story of Glazer and the bubble chamber, the eels, the ace and the Mississippi. The world is just too lively a place. We can interfere performatively with it, and it will respond, it will do something, but there's no guarantee whatsoever that the response will be what we expect. Second, we could ask where emergence has gone in Ruzick's calculation. The answer is that conventional science substitutes for it, replacing genuinely lively nature with machine-like representations that we can reason around. The levers of power are clear on paper, then, though not in the world. The same could be said of the Army Corps of Engineers. They, too, use the best science of hydrology and what have you in their dealings with the Mississippi. Sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes emergence breaks through, as in Hurricane Katrina in 2005. There's the Mississippi at the top left, there is New Orleans underwater after Hurricane Katrina at the bottom right. Where can we go now? One point that should be acknowledged, and that certainly needs more thought, is that sometimes we do manage to get on top of nature, so to speak. Machines do work reliably. Roofs do keep the rain in. Usually we think about this in representational terms. Engineers explain to us how bubble chambers or nuclear reactors work in terms of some known laws of nature. And we usually treat that as the end of the story. So perhaps one virtue of the turn to performance is to open this whole question up again. From my perspective, the production of reliable machines is not primarily a cognitive achievement at all. It depends, rather, on finding performative islands of stability, as I tend to call them, in intersections between the human and the non-human. These are not, in fact, guaranteed in any sense by knowledge. It's better to see knowledge as growing out of them. And these islands of stability are chancy things. Our footing on them has to be continually adjusted in a performative fashion. Bubble chambers and nuclear power stations have to be serviced and maintained to keep them in shape. And this, too, takes the form of dances of agency. And we should recognize that sometimes we just lose our footing. In the first generation of bubble chambers, the Harvard MIT machine exploded, killing one person, injuring several others, and causing millions of dollars worth of damage. For the equivalent in the nuclear world, the word Fukushima will probably do the trick. Picture of a nuclear power station exploding. But the question I want to consider now is, does my story of dances of agency help us think about other ways to go on in the world, other ways to conduct our performances? I think it does, actually, and this gets us back to questions of environmental management and governance. Our hegemonic, our standard taken-for-granted way of governing is, I think, the one I've been describing, which, as it happens, Martin Heidegger called enframing, turning the world into standing reserve. It entails a detour, as Bruno Latour would say, through science. We turn the world into scientific representations, figure out how to dominate those representations, and then remake the world in line with our calculations. This detour, of course, is precisely the place where emergence disappears and where things can go horribly wrong. What's the alternative? Skip the detour, forget about representations, forget about science. Recognize instead that our being in the world is at root performative and act that out. Okay, now we have definitely arrived in outer space. Words, language, symbols, representations, science, these are the stock in trade of academics like us, and my recommendation is to forget about them. Or, to speak in more measured terms, I want to put them in their place, to see them as a small part of a world of performance and becoming, by no means the centre of it. So I'm not really surprised when my colleagues look at me blankly when I say things like I just said. But I want to press on a bit anyway. Really, the only question is, what would this other way of going on, which Heidegger called poesis, and I like to call the stance of revealing, look like? Could we live without the detour through science and knowledge? Let me try to spin out some examples in the spirit of an existence proof, moving from rather passive relations to nature to more active ones. I live in the X Valley down in Devon. You can see very easily where the floodplain of the X is, hemmed in by those pretty Devon hills. The floodplain is basically empty land, populated usually by cows and sheep. When the river floods, as it quite often does, the cows, the sheep and the farmers stroll off to higher land in the hills. There are a few more or less ancient raised tracks crossing the floodplain, walkways, railways, roadways, which look pretty odd and intriguing most of the time, but whose purpose becomes totally obvious when the waters rise. Here's a couple. This is the the bridge over the river at Stoke Cannon. It's very foreshortened. There's a couple of tiny little streams and a bridge that's like a quarter of a mile long spanning them. I used to wonder, why is this incredibly long bridge here? This is the path from Stoke Cannon to Bramford Speke, where I used to live. The path is this raised pile of rocks, like 20 feet above the river on one side and 15 feet above the fields on the other. I used to imagine the monks had built it or something, walking down there in the Middle Ages, till my children pointed out it was an abandoned railway track, actually. But I was fascinated by these strange architectural things for a long time, until the first time the river flooded, and then I realised what was going on. We could say that over the centuries, people in the Ex-Valley have found a way of living in dynamic equilibrium with the river. That this has involved very little by way of a detour through science, and that it works. The present configuration of the Ex-Valley is the upshot of a stance of revealing, a performative openness to what the river will do, and a performative response to that. The beautiful village that I now live in, and the strange river architecture around it, have grown out of a very long dance of ages. Of course, the Ex is a little river. It's not so important in the grand scheme of things. The Rhine, on the other hand, is big and important. And it strikes me that the current Room for Rivers project in Holland is a revival of this traditional stance that I've been talking about. Room for Rivers, as I understand it, aims to let the river flood, in the spirit that it's better to adapt to regular, finite floods than to try to pin down and enframe the river with the disasters and catastrophes that inevitably follow. I'm tempted to call Room for Rivers a Hylozoist project. Hylozoism, for me, is the idea that everything we need is there already in nature, and that we can latch onto it directly and performatively instead of going through these long detours of cognition for the sake of bending nature to our will. I started thinking about this when I was trying to understand cybernetic biological computing projects in the 1950s and 1960s. There, the truly amazing idea was somehow to entrain pond ecosystems, for example, to manage factories. Now it strikes me that water engineering in general might be moving in this Hylozoist direction, a realization that maybe nature is better at controlling itself than we are. That's a biological computing picture from a book by Gordon Pask. It's the picture of a swamp, needless to say, and the headline is "A real-life modular processor." I love that. Figure that one out. These were examples of letting go. Now I can turn to more active relations with nature. The last time I was in Oxford, Sarah Watmore showed us a picture of novel dams being built upstream of a Yorkshire town called Pickering, of all places. And this is the picture she showed. Not the picture she emailed me yesterday under false pretense. The novelty of the dams that Sarah was talking about is that they look as though they've been built by beavers rather than by engineers. They're simply tangled meshes of branches thrown across a stream. I don't know whether they work, but what fascinates me about them is that rather than dominating streams via a detour through science, they stage an exploratory dance of agency with the streams, finding out how nature will respond. Obviously, the state of the dams and how they act depends on their history, how much detritus has been washed down and caught by the dams or detached from them. As I say, I don't know if they work, maybe Sarah does. But anyway, this is engineering in the mode of revealing rather than enframing and dominating through knowledge. Moving from the micro to the macro, I'm fascinated by the Dujiangyan Dam in China. 2,000 years old, this dam is famous for the elegance of its performance. It acts differently according to the season and the water flow in the river, variously diverting water into irrigation channels and dampening out floods. It all has to do with this island in the middle of the curve of the river. I haven't been able to find out much about the history of the dam's construction, but it's safe to say it wasn't designed scientifically. And certainly its maintenance, at least, crucially entails a dance of human and non-human agency. The dam structure is not fixed. Every year it's eroded by water flows, and every year it's rebuilt in line with the experience of the previous year. Not coincidentally, I think, it's one of the places where heaven and earth are joined. There always seems to be a spiritual angle on these Hylozoist relations with nature. It's another picture of the same place, and there's a temple right on the edge of the water. Staying in China for a moment, we could think about the Chinese concept of Shi, S-H-I. As the title of François Julien's great book explains, Shi refers to the propensity of things, that's the title of the book, to act in specific ways. The moral here is that successful human action depends upon latching on to the Shi of whatever situation one finds oneself in, going with the flow in the Taoist sense. I'm told that this way of thinking is just basic common sense in China, though it's totally alien, obviously, to Western academic thought. What puzzles me about it is how one is supposed to know which way Xi is pointing. What is the propensity of this situation or that? But thinking about this can move us towards consideration of some even more active ways of relating to the environment and the mode of revealing. In his important book, Seeing Like a State, Jim Scott refers to a body of thought and action that he calls metis, which he sees as a less poisonous alternative to modernist rationalization. And he gives an example that I find striking of a traditional Japanese approach to the environment. Quote, "Erosion control in Japan is like a game of chess. The forest engineer, after studying his eroding valley, makes his first move, locating and building one or more check dams. He waits to see what nature's response is. This determines the forest engineer's next move, which may be another dam or two, an increase in the former dam, or the construction of side retaining walls. Another pause for observation, the next move is made, and so on, until erosion is checkmated. The operation of natural forces, such as sedimentation and revegetation, are guided and used to the best advantage to keep down costs and to obtain practical results." Clearly here, the forest engineer is finding out what the propensity of the valley and the water is. And he does that by deliberately staging a performative dance of agency with it. Trying this, seeing what happens, trying something else, and so on. Just like Glaser with his trial bubble chambers. So here we have a very nice example of a sort of purposeful finding out how to control nature without any detour through science and representation, a way of trading on the dance of agency rather than trying to shortcut it through knowledge. One point to emphasize then is that a performative perspective does not require us simply to let nature go its own way, as in the X Valley. Rather, it opens up the possibility of foregrounding emergent dances of agency in practice rather than casting a scientific veil over them. It might also be worth noting that you can speak of experiment in this connection. The Japanese forest engineer certainly experiments on water flows in the valley. But this is not the same sense of experiment as that usually associated with science. Scientific experiment depends on the detour I've been talking about, a displacement of phenomena away from the world and into the lab for the sake of producing knowledge which can then be re-exported to the world, which is, for example, how the Army Corps of Engineers proceeds in its dealings with the Mississippi. Scott's example points to another sort of experiment which entails performative interaction with the thing itself, with no displacement and focused on a performative outcome rather than exportable knowledge. Experimentation in the wild, we could call it. And again, we can scale this example up and bring it more up to date. My former student, Lisa Asplin, wrote some beautiful papers about performative ways of getting along with the environment. The easiest one to think about is called adaptive management. Just like the Japanese example, adaptive management, as I understand it, is all about experimentation in the wild and staging dances of agency as a way of exploring the she of any given situation. Lisa talks about experimental floods on the Colorado River staged downstream from the Glen Canyon Dam. And this might actually be the paradigmatic example of adaptive management, for all I know, adaptive environmental management. That's the Glen Canyon Dam in the west of the United States. The idea of these experimental floods was precisely to find out how the river and the downstream ecosystem would react to different flows of water as a basis for further dealings with them. One important point that Lisa emphasizes is that while the scientists involved did have conventional scientific representations of river dynamics, they were prepared to find out that they were wrong, as indeed some of them were. Valuable monitoring equipment simply got washed away. The river and ecosystem reconfigured themselves and performed in ways that surprised the scientists. This sort of experimentation in the wild, then, is alive to emergence in the dance of agency, interested in it, and not trying to short-circuit it through knowledge. Lisa also wrote about projects of ecological restoration. These sound a bit like classic enframing exercises, trying to make nature conform to a given representation of what it should look like. But what Lisa stressed is, again, that the restorers are alive to emergence, allowing their targets to shift in the light of what emerges in the dance of agency. A whole new ecological formation popped up in the case that she studied. Okay, that's the end of my examples. Where have we got to? From one angle, my basic idea is that we can understand the world as built from performative dances of agency. That's what there is in the world. That's my ontological vision. Then my idea is that we usually contrive not to see this. We edit out the emergent aspects of the dance by substituting non-emergent scientific representations for them, and then we act on the basis of those representations. Like Heidegger, I think this is our characteristic way of inhabiting the world in modernity, in relating to the environment and in much else. But a spin-off of my analysis is that it helps us imagine another way of being in the world, of experimenting directly in and learning from dances of agency, instead of conjuring them away through some epistemological sleight of hand. I haven't dwelt on this, but I think also it's obvious from my examples that this other way of going on, the Hylozoist stance of revealing, is at least much less prone to catastrophic to a catastrophic dark side than the stance of enframing and domination, which is something very much, I would say, in its favour. From another angle, this talk is an attempt to persuade myself and others that there are interesting and possibly important things to be said in the performative idiom. As I said before, I often feel like I've arrived in outer space, but I don't think it has to be outer space, even for academics. Actually, I think it should be our home, the place we set out from and return to in our explorations. And to finish, maybe I should explore just a bit further how we should think about science in this way of grasping the world. I said earlier that we should get rid of science, and I immediately qualified that by saying I really want to put science in its place. What's going on here? We can start by thinking about the sort of conventional scientific knowledge that my friend Dave Ruzick used to calculate the carrying capacity of the Earth. I feel like saying that we need more of this sort of knowledge, but that we should trust it less. The worst thing we can do is forget about emergence by adopting a hard, realist interpretation of current beliefs and putting them into practice, come what may. I'm afraid that's how we actually go on most of the time. I hope that's what environmental scientists are now realizing doesn't work very well and simply invites disaster. Instead, we should see scientific knowledge for what it is, a situated, partial, and retrospective way of making sense of what's happened so far. Cognitively, it's the best we can do. It's our way of thinking about the future. But it's always liable to go wrong. Novelty will emerge from the dance of agency. And then we will, or should, revise our actions and beliefs. Practically, this means that when we try to act out our scientific visions, we should be on the alert for surprises and willing to modify both our knowledge and our plans accordingly. Constant monitoring of worldly performance. That's what I mean by saying we should trust science less. One of the cyberneticians that I studied, Stafford Beer, once wrote a paper with a great title, The Surrogate World We Manage. His argument was that much management is totally focused on a paper world of representations, and that the real world consequences of this range from regrettable to catastrophic. Think of the so-called financial crisis. That is the sort of environmental management we need to beware of. And I could just mention, to go off on a bit of a tangent, that this always seemed a rather abstract point to me until I moved back to Britain in 2007. I now work in one of those surrogate worlds that Beer warned us about. I'm sure that the University of Exeter looks totally splendid on paper. You can actually find diagrams of reporting chains and flowcharts on whiteboards in the administrators' offices. The university is a perfect machine on paper. At the ground level, in contrast, where I live, we're all going mad, trying to reconcile teaching and research with a stream of impossibly unrealistic commands that come through these days. I imagine many rivers feel the same. And just to follow this tangent a bit further, this reminds me of another of my cyberneticians, Gregory Bateson. Bateson moved from an interest in schizophrenia in the 1950s to environmental concerns in the 60s and 70s, and he gave much the same analysis of both. Both circle around attempts to stamp a modern blueprint onto an emergently lively system, enframing selves or rivers respectively, and the disastrous consequences that follow when these projects fail. Hurricane Katrina as the madness of the Mississippi. Madness as the Hurricane Katrina of the soul. We can go back to science. I increasingly think it makes sense to distinguish between two different paradigms in Kuhn's sense for thinking about and acting in the world. One is the modern paradigm, exemplified in my talk by Ruzick's calculations. As Heidegger said, this draws on the sort of science that makes the world calculable and sets it up for enframing. But there's a different kind of science that Heidegger didn't think about, which represents the world differently. Cybernetics would be one example of this other paradigm, but complexity theory is probably a more relevant version today. I'm not an expert in this version of environmental science, but on Laura's recommendations, I read a few papers as a way of preparing for this talk, including the writings of Karl Falker, who I think is the last speaker in this series. So, what can I say about that? First, I like the complexity approach a lot. Instead of linear models of cause and effect, it offers us a vision of basins of attraction in highly complex socio-ecological formations, attractors that pull these entities back to specific sorts of states until one crosses a boundary when they flip over to another attractor, for better or for worse. This sounds to me like a much better representation of how the world is than calculations of the carrying capacity of the Earth. And this sort of representation certainly serves as a warning against trying too quickly to edit out emergence and surprise. But two questions arrive from a performative perspective. One goes back to the question of realism. Should we just believe these sorts of representations? Do they literally describe how the world is? My friend in the world of Deleuzean philosophy, Manuel de Landa, would say yes to that question, and then he'd go on about attractors as the structure of the Deleuzean virtual. I'm inclined to say no. What complexity is good for is the construction of an alternative and non-modern imaginary for people who need that sort of thing. If you're a fan of science and you'd like to think your way out of enframing, read a few papers by Falker et al. They will show you how even a simple determinist world can nevertheless continually surprise us. But from another angle, I'm inclined to wonder what else complexity can do for us. I don't think there's much hope of ever pinning down the actual complexities of any important real ecosystem, of mapping the attractors and their boundaries. And I certainly don't think there's any hope of doing that for socio-ecological systems. Speaking ex cathedra as some sort of sociologist, multi-agent models of social systems, for example, don't remind me of anything I've come across in my research. The social world isn't built from N interchangeable and otherwise identical agents. At best, these models can function, again, as aids to the imagination, which is not unimportant. In the end, what fascinates me is how necessary people find it to embark on incredibly long, complex, expensive, and tiring detours through science to get hold of what sort of a place the world is. Why bother when you simply have to look? Why is it so hard for us to see that we live in a world that just is lively and surprising? Why indeed? It probably starts with what we teach our children at school, but that is another story. And that's the end. Thank you.